This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. At the end of the January 6th committee's eighth public hearing last month, Vice Chair Republican Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming asked the nation whether Donald Trump can ever again be trusted to hold the reins of this democracy.
We must remember that we cannot abandon the truth and remain a free nation.
Truth and freedom are intertwined. Democracy protects truth, and truth protects democracies. Or so we believe. But what if a democracy is as much a safe space for lies as it is for the truth? What if democracy carries the seeds of its own destruction? What if, in fact, democracy is the necessary precursor to fascism, to authoritarianism? Well, my guests today say exactly that. They are co-authors of a new book called The Paradox of Democracy: Free Speech, Open Media, and Perilous Persuasion. Zach Gershberg teaches journalism and media studies at Idaho State University, and he joins us today from Pocatello, Idaho. Zach, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna.
And Sean Ealing is a senior writer at Vox and host of the Conversations podcast there. He joins us from Gulfport, Mississippi. Sean, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us today is Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst, who joins us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna, Zach, and Sean.
Well, I'd actually like to start first with what you all, or your response to what we played from Representative Cheney there about you can't abandon truth and remain a free nation. Sean, what do you think about that?
Well, that strikes me as a bit naive. I'm not even sure what she means. If she means that truth is something that we can expect to prevail in a free society, I don't see a lot of evidence for that. If she means truth is something that a majority of the population is invested in or prioritizes, I'm not sure there's a lot of evidence for that either. I think truth is something to which we all aspire, but in a wide open democratic culture, truth does not always prevail. Sometimes it's lies. Sometimes it's demagoguery. Sometimes it's whatever. It is a wide open chaotic culture, and there is no guarantee that the truth will win out. And very often it doesn't.
Well, Zach, I presume that part of what Representative Cheney means is that when you have large numbers of people, both the demos of democracy, the people and the people's representatives, who are turning their back on certain realities, that that is a sign of a crisis in that democracy. So is our democracy right now in crisis, Zach?
I believe so. But we also try to make the point in the book that democracies are always under crisis because persuasion, not truth, functions as the main variable in which these communities take place. And so what truth does, it sets an impossible standard. And this is why Plato really hated democracy for that reason, because it could not achieve it. And so we're just trying to point out that truth ultimately is not, we can endeavor to establish a forensic record, and that's important, but it may not cohere.
Well, by the way, both of you feel free to jump in anytime. I don't necessarily want to just exclusively, turn one question to one of you versus the other. So let me just ask this. When you say persuasion is really sort of the lifeblood of how you define what a democracy is versus truth, what do you mean?
Sure, that democracies allow space for free expression, from the Greek concept of isagoria in ancient Athens to the First Amendment in the United States. And so what happens when that is privileged in such a society? Persuasion, the ability to communicate with one another and convince one another of different things about what we should do, but also what exists, what is real, what is true. And so we take a more expansive look at persuasion rather than just convincing someone else of a particular policy.
Yeah, if I can jump in there, you know, I would say, and I'll speak here as a journalist, our whole profession is built on the idea that the truth matters, and we communicate the truth to the public as best we can. Sometimes we make arguments, usually with words, about what's unjust or what we ought to do, and we believe that if we persuade enough people, if we inform enough people, our political system will work. Our democracy will work. But I don't think there's any reason to believe that model really holds up today. Journalists have spent the last 6 or 7 years debunking lies and highlighting corruption, and it's not clear to me that it's made a bit of difference, partly because the information space is very saturated and fragmented and polarized, partly because a lot of people don't trust mainstream media anymore for all kinds of reasons. But it's also because, and this is important to the argument we make in the book, it's also because democracy isn't necessarily a battle of arguments and ideas. It can be if we're communicating in the right way, but the tools we have now, TV and the internet in particular, are all about imagery and reaction, and they incentivize cruelty and volume, and they traffic in memes and outrage. And you know, mediums like Instagram and TikTok and Snapchat, these are not mediums for ideas and arguments. In so many ways, 20th century journalism is increasingly a kind of anachronism. And we're just in this convergent space where things are changing and it's just not clear where they're going.
Yeah. You know, I just have to say, we hear a slight little interruption in your line, Sean. We're going to work on fixing that here. Just want to acknowledge to listeners, if you're hearing that, so are we. We're going to work on it. But so what you're saying is that, I mean, in your book, you lay out this case about how we perhaps should not think of democracy so much as an institutional construct, right? One person, one vote, and the representation of that vote through the institutions of government, but rather as almost a social act, this act of persuading each other of the superiority of certain beliefs and ideas. Zach, first of all, do I have that right? And if I do, second, why is that an important differentiation in how you see what democracies are?
I think you put it very well, in some ways better than maybe Sean or I could. So I appreciate that. but it is significant to articulate it in that way, because I think, especially during times of democratic pressure or intimidation, we sometimes think the institutions will save us, or that we use phrases like democracy is on the ballot, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And so the vehicle through which democracy works is the openness of communication, the ability for free expression, and voting functions. It is important, so we're not downplaying that. But voting functions as an expression of the voice of different people. And I think we should, I mean, Sean and I certainly support expanding the franchise as much as possible. But the sense to which that the law is somehow binding on democracy is not something that we can automatically take for granted, when in a system of free expression, people can use rhetoric to lobby against democracy and the very notion of having an open society.
Well, Jack Beatty, what's your take on Zach and Sean's notion that democracy, we ought to look at democracy more as a social act of persuasion, and therefore really look at how we communicate with each other as an important factor about whether a democracy will persist or perish?
Well, there's such an irony here. You know, in Plato's dialogues, the sophists, they are the great rhetoricians, the persuaders. And Aristophanes, in one of his plays, says they had the ability to make the worst appear the better reason. And there's such an irony that the great persuader, the great rhetorician of our time, perhaps of all time, is Donald Trump, who may never have read a book in his adult life, save the volume of Hitler's speeches his wife Ivanka said he kept in a bedside drawer. The irony of this literate really, as a master of rhetoric or persuasion, such that he's converted a once great political party into a mass movement based on delusions and lies, oceanic grievance and self-pity. The irony of this man as the great persuader is just too bitter to contemplate.
Mm. Zach, we've got a minute here to go. Do you see that as an irony or, in fact, the perfect example of your argument that democracy is really an act of persuasion?
Oh, I think it's a great example, and there's a double irony here. In our book, we actually defend the sophists somewhat against Plato's critique of them, because the sophists functioned as both thinkers as well as executors within the public sphere, engaging other citizens. And so I think it's important to note that you cannot have a democracy without rhetoric or sophistry. It's baked in. But we do have the examples of demagogues, as Jack was so clearly elucidating.
Well, we're talking this hour with Zach Gershberg and Sean Illing. They are co-authors of a new book called The Paradox of Democracy, Free Speech, Open Media, and Perilous Persuasion. Jack Beattie, On Point's news analyst, also joins us as well. We'll have more, so stay with us. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking with Zach Gershberg and Sean Illing. They are co-authors of a new book called The Paradox of Democracy, Free Speech, Open Media, and Perilous Persuasion. Jack Beattie, On Point's news analyst, is also with us. And Jack, you know, in Zach and Sean's book, they make this argument that democracy has always had the seeds of its own destruction within it. And earlier today, you were referencing a quote from John Adams, I believe, that was along the same lines, Jack?
Yes, and I get it from our guests. Okay. I'm rushing now to find it in my notes, and they probably know it better than I do, but it leapt out at me as kind of amazing. Where is it now, gentlemen? I'm looking for it. Here it is. Chapter 2. All right, we go to chapter 2. Here it is. John Adams. Sorry. This is John Adams. There never was a democracy yet that did not commit suicide. Oof.
Wow. Okay, so we're going to... Zach and Sean, in the book, you sort of do this tour through history of the many times that you say that has happened or the major changes that have sped, let's say, a democracy towards an ill-fated end. Let's start near the beginning, because you spend a little bit of time in ancient Athens and Socrates. Sean, why? What's important about that?
I think Zach can better speak to Socrates and Athens, but I love that Jack just went to John Adams. It's because early America is such an instructive example of the disruptive, double-edged quality of new media that we're talking about. You know, we had the First Amendment, which made America a uniquely wide-open culture of speech, and it was a total mess. Pamphlets were vital to establishing a shared political culture in those early years, but they were also vehicles for confusion and discord. You had James Madison and Alexander Hamilton. These two were really close friends, but they have a falling out and they started opposing political parties. And those parties had their own newspapers, and those were the primary political weapons. And they were so effective that the Federalists passed the Alien and Sedition Act in 1798 so that they could squash the Republican press. And John Adams, one of the staunchest defenders of a free press, signed it. And we love this story because it's a wonderful example of how media giveth and taketh,
right.
So of how these powerful tools can create and undo.
The tools, so the communications revolutions, however they're enacted within societies. Okay, so we're going to keep that in mind, but I do want to, just because my personal knowledge of ancient Athens is pretty limited. So Zach, why Socrates in the context of this book?
Well, I think it's really important because Socrates becomes Plato's mouthpiece, who is against democracy and against the sophists, as we were discussing before the break. And the important thing here is these novel ways of communicating, the new forms of writing, the new forms of rhetoric that the sophists were theorizing and teaching were vital to having this fledgling democracy in Athens. But at the same time, we also know that these tools of persuasion and communication, the dramatic theater, contests of sport, speaking contests as well, create this cultural dynamic that is a little bit chaotic. And there are people using their free expression at the time to basically snuff out democracy and install an oligarchy, a rule from certain oligarchs. And we kind of find ourselves in a similar position where we have a democracy and there are people looking to unwind the democratic public sphere.
Okay, so just to recap, because this is a really different take on what a democracy is. You're saying, both of you are saying that it's really sort of this societal level act of persuasion versus the strict institutions that we might think of as democracies. And that then that is both something to aim for, but also because of the openness and the ability for multiple ideas to be in, you know, contest with each other through persuasion, sows the seeds of perhaps its own demise. And what might accelerate that fragility are the communications revolutions through which certain forms of persuasion may supersede others. Okay, so let's tangle with that a little bit more. Sean, what's sort of the next major communications revolution, you think, demonstrates this theory? Is it indeed the advent of the printing press?
I think so. I mean, that's certainly a good example with the printing press, which you get in the 15th century. I mean, books existed, but with the printing press, you get the mass production of books and newspapers. And that led the way to the Enlightenment and the democratic revolutions of the 18th century. And that's all good and wonderful, but it also paved the way to a devastating religious conflict that devoured a continent. I mean, that's a case where, again, media giveth and taketh. And it's not that these tools are necessarily good or bad. It's that they are disruptive and unpredictable, and they shake up. They change us, they change our culture, and they change our politics in ways that are very hard to manage and very hard to predict, hence the disruptive quality of them.
So let's pick up on a couple more examples on this historical tour. The Telegraph, Zach?
Yes. So the Telegraph is incredibly important and starts to coincide with this revolutionary fervor in Europe in the 1840s. As well as coming off the heels of new forms of printing that led to a penny press. And so what happens is the telegraph becomes this sort of major feature of the 19th century. And it's the first time that communication can exceed the rate of human travel. And it's really remarkable and leads to these reform efforts in Europe, but it's we see the American Civil War, we see wars of imperialism, as the control for space takes place, leading us sort of into World War I and the Bolshevik Revolution as well in the early 20th century.
Hmm. So I know this seems like, I hope it doesn't seem too superficial that we're just doing this like high speed race through history here. But because you guys go into much more detail in the book. And again, it's called The Paradox of Democracy. But, you know, I'm just sort of try to connect some dots here. So the next one, and this one is particularly obviously interesting to me, because you talk about how fascism could, or you make the argument that fascism could not have taken hold the way it did had it not been for radio. Sean or Zach, pick that up.
You can take that one, Zach.
Okay. Yeah, so we spend our chapter on fascism is really devoted to the early years of fascist movements, particularly in Italy with Benito Mussolini, who had a newspaper and a column in a newspaper. And then once he gains power, you know, his regime is using the radio in particular. And we see this very early on from the night Hitler is granted power. Goebbels is on the radio. And so radio becomes a really important medium to consolidate power well before World War II or the Holocaust. And it becomes this primary means. Since we're on radio, I suppose I should say it's a powerful and intimate medium and can be used in a good way to expand democratic potential. But we also see how it can be used in a really manipulative way as well.
Hmm. I mean, the point that you try to make throughout the book is that with each of these communications revolutions, what changes is how arguments are made, or how or what effective persuasion looks like. And by virtue of that being changed, the actual politics of the moment change as well, right?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, since we're making this tour through the history of, you know, media revolutions, I'll mention television.
Yeah.
Because this is a very good example. Television was the last major media revolution that took place far enough in the past that we have a very clear sense of what it has done. And I get asked a variation of this question all the time, which is something like, you know, how do you know our politics is still shaped by TV? And the short answer is to look at how needlessly stupid our whole political process has become. Mm. The debates are stupid. The campaigns are stupid. The ads are stupid. Cable news is mostly stupid. And those stupidities are very much reflections of the medium of television, a medium that traffics in imagery and optics. And Neil Postman, a famous media ecologist who wrote the book Amusing Ourselves to Death, made a really important point. And that was that we shouldn't judge a culture by its trivialities. We should judge it by what it treats as significant. And the problem is that TV, a passive medium designed to entertain, is now, and has been for a long time, a carrier of our most important cultural conversations. It's where so much of our politics unfolds. Mm. And in all kinds of ways, TV has remade politics in its image. I mean, if anyone has watched a presidential debate, it's marketed like it's a WWE event. It is a spectacle. And people get 20 seconds to answer questions about how to fix climate change or something. I mean, it is a bastardization of the democratic process. But because it plays out on the medium of TV, it has to work. It has to bend to the biases of TV. And that's why so much of our politics is the way it is, because TV is a primary medium on which it plays out.
Yeah. You know, Jack, let me turn to you here, because perhaps I'm about to provide an example that's the exception that proves the rule, but weren't those Lincoln-Douglas debates also something of a spectacle, a 19th century spectacle?
Well, they were. And what's striking about them, though, is the attention span the audience had to have.
Hours and exactly. Hours and hours. Yeah.
You know, you can't believe the length. And they would stop and come back the next day. So, yeah, people were listening, those who could stay awake. But I think the authors make such a crucial point. Television is all about entertaining. And everything, entertainment understood as distraction, right? We're thinking about ourselves and our problems, and here we have a commercial. We can think about something else. It is a medium to take your mind off everything serious and focus on whatever the next sensation is. It's a, if we survive it, it'll be a miracle.
Well, I'm not sure. I can't imagine if anyone in 1860 said, "I'm going to vote for Abraham Lincoln because that's a guy I'd like to have a beer with." But Zach and Sean, let me just ask you, how does what you're saying, though, materially differ from, you know, the Marshall McLuhan assessment of culture and media and politics about the medium being the message?
Sure. Thank you. Well, I think what we're trying to do is adapt some of those perspectives from media theory and graft them onto understanding politics, particularly democratic politics, and how democracies work and have worked. And the one thing I would point out where we do actually differ is that even though we accept that each medium will have its own logic and rhythm to how it works, one thing we sort of stress in the book is that people who are successful or parties that are successful for good reasons and in bad often figure out a way for how to leverage a convergence of different media or are able to inspire a certain network of communication. So if there's a figure like Trump, Jack mentioned earlier his sort of rhetorical style, but it's also, I think, important to note he dominated the tabloid press of the 1980s, even being his own press agent. He wrote bestsellers and took his company public in the 90s. He dominated reality television in the 2000s. He was an early adopter of Twitter and led a conspiracy theory during the Obama presidency, all leading into kind of this presidential run where he dominated both television as well as had these networks pop up globally in support of him during his initial run for presidency. So I think that is a distinction that we're able to try to make.
Okay. But Sean, let me ask you, the idea that communications revolutions are massively disruptive, not just to democracies, but to humanity as a whole, I'm completely on board with that. I mean, I think any technological revolution is going to change how we live. But in terms of the fragility of a democracy, our democracy at the moment, isn't the actual source of the fragility not just the change in what or how persuasion is done, but the fact that we have had now for many decades a deliberate use of that power of persuasion to attack the very institutions of democracy, disenfranchising people, gerrymandering, people have, issues with the Electoral College, et cetera, that the fragility only emerges when the persuasion is used to undermine the democracy itself.
I think that's right. In a lot of ways, we're really, because the culture is now so wide open, now that everyone has a platform to speak, we can see that a lot of people are very angry. They're not happy with their lives. They don't feel represented or heard. And if you're on the wrong side of inequality, the wrong side of post-industrial capitalism, you're pretty justified in your anger. And all that anger is being channeled and amplified by the internet. Whereas in the past, it simply existed off the radar, behind the scenes. It was pushed to the margins. And it's even worse than that because the internet also allows the angriest among us to connect with other angry people and mutually reinforce their anger. It's interesting, there was some research that came out a few weeks ago showing that cable TV actually is still the main driver of partisanship. And that's true enough, but the thing about the internet is that it allows people to go down rabbit holes. It radicalizes in a way that TV never could because there are no boundaries. So I don't think you get January 6th without the internet.
Well, Sean Illing and Zach Gershberg are co-authors of the new book, The Paradox of Democracy, Free Speech, Open Media, and Perilous persuasion. Jack Beattie, I'm going to hear more from you in just a moment. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I just want to give you a little preview about what we're going to be working on for Monday's show. We're going to be celebrating the lives and legacies of NBA legend Bill Russell and actress Nichelle Nichols, two giants in American history, cultural and civil rights history, two Black pioneers who both recently died. And we want to hear your memories of Bill Russell, of Nichelle Nichols, how they changed American culture and how Americans thought about civil rights in the 60s and 70s. So call us with your stories at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, we're talking with Zach Gershberg and Sean Illing. They're co-authors of the book, The Paradox of Democracy, Free Speech, Open Media, and Perilous Persuasion. So Jack Beattie, let me hear from you, because I hear what Sean and Zach are saying, that we really, it's worthwhile to think of democracy as this act of persuasion. But when we talk about its then internal fragility, I still come to this conclusion that the fragility starts expressing itself when the persuasion turns into action, right? There's something about what is said on social media or cable TV, even, you know, here on the radio, that is persuasive enough that it's leading people to act in a way that is destroying or undermining American democracy. What do you think about that, Jack?
Yeah, I think there's an audacity barrier, right? Once it's said, once you've said something that's, you know, everything is permitted, and suddenly you give the green light for it. And of course, Trump he's the Pied Piper of this kind of thing. And I just want to emphasize something: how dangerous he is to a democracy. How dangerous it is to have a public man, someone who could be the next president of a democracy, denying democracy, and to raise the question whether the laws ought not to protect us against that. You know, Dick Cheney just said yesterday in an ad, in our nation's 246-year history, there's never been an individual who was a greater threat to our republic than Donald Trump. Last week, that threat was on display in Trump's first visit to Washington, a speech he gave there. He came out for stripping civil service protection for 50,000 federal employees and putting in his own people to take their places. And according to one report, Steve Bannon is even now running boot camps for these new cadres. But even more frighteningly, he came out for federalizing the National Guard and sending it into blue state cities to suppress crime and no doubt suppress demonstrations and demonstrators. And of course, we remember that his biggest regret, asked by a reporter, his biggest regret about his tenure in office was that he didn't do that, that he didn't use the army against demonstrators. Now he's coming out for sending the National Guard into cities to suppress dissent, probably while they're at it to force women to bear children too. So we have before us a man who means to bring down the Constitution. And you know, famously it's been said the Constitution is not a suicide pact. Isn't there a way that shouldn't we have laws to protect us against this, against an anti-democrat, a man running to be president who wants to end democracy? Isn't there some way that clear and present danger can be suppressed?
Mm. Well, Zach or Sean, go ahead.
I mean, I guess I'd say, sure, I'm fully behind that. The problem with laws and institutions is that they're only as good as the people who make them up. And one thing we learned, certainly in the last 5, 6, 7 years, is on the one hand, there's a success story to tell here. Trump was ultimately defeated. His attempts to overturn an election failed. That is a win. That is a win for our democracy. But he did show what's possible if you're really willing to go as far as it takes. If you're really willing to abandon any pretense of liberal democracy, and if you're willing to just go after power by any means necessary, there are people who will go along with you mm-hmm. for all kinds of reasons. And so I guess in that sense, what has happened in recent memory is both a kind of comfort, but also terrifying.
Well, also, you point out in the book that, let's see if I remember this correctly, that say, and thank goodness this did not happen, but let's imagine for a moment that the mob that attacked the Capitol on January 6th had succeeded in, you know, getting its hands on some of the elected representatives in the building, or perhaps even, you know, captured Vice President Pence, that that Donald Trump, as then president, could have had the power to, like, I don't know, suspend communications or something. I'm not remembering yes. this well. Tell me what you guys were talking about. Yeah.
Yes. So there's a sort of break within federal communications, where if the president declares a national emergency, he can shut off or take over the radio, television, the telephone system, including cell phones. And so this hasn't really been discussed by the January 6th commission in Congress. And I think, as Sean noted, it is incredibly important. You know, there's a lot of discussion about whether we're a well-functioning democracy and all the pathologies of legislation in Congress. But we did repulse, our country was able to repulse a demagogue who sought permanent power. That was disrupted. And that is a sort of victory for democracy. And we sort of make the case that democracies should exist, that there are benefits to them, even though we strike a little bit of a pessimistic tone. And so I think that's an important distinction that has gotten lost with all the other anxieties we're experiencing, which are also real.
Hmm. But let me get back to something that the point that I think Jack was making, that even in this view of democracy as being this act of persuasion within a society, that the institutions themselves play a role in protecting that democracy. So are there any legal or institutional changes that can and must be made in order to shore up the fragilities that you're talking about that are revealed when sufficient numbers of people are persuaded to act in opposition to the democracy they live in?
It's an important question. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Zach.
Well, one thing I just find amusing is for all the talk about constitutional interpretation, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is pretty clear. I mean, if you engage in insurrection or rebellion against the Constitution of the United States, you cannot hold office. So, again, I don't know if this is something the January 6th committee is going to explore or refer to DOJ. To me, it seems pretty obvious. It just doesn't seem like there is a legal or political will to do anything about it. Worried about because of worries over the perceptions or the political consequences.
Yeah. Sean, go ahead. I'm looking for solutions here.
I'm so terribly sorry to disappoint yet again. I wish I had them. I think Zach is basically right there. The laws are on the books. Their laws are on the books. The problem with laws and institutions is that they are grounded and undergirded by a culture that sustains them. And the Republican Party, perhaps correctly, is making a bet that they can behave in the way they're behaving and that they'll be able to get away with it because enough of their voters are okay with it, either in some normative sense or because they're cocooned and self-sorted in the way they consume information about the world, that they are convinced that the other side is an existential threat and that this is, you know, you have to play dice with democracy in order to save it or whatever. But they're making a gamble that they can get away with this. And they've achieved quite a bit so far. And we'll see where it goes. But yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I refuse to be left feeling so powerless, you know, in defense of our democracy, regardless of political persuasion one leans towards. And here's why. I want to refocus on your communications revolution part of the book, because I think it's really important. And we as a democracy, left, center, right, however you want to talk about it, we can hold, especially regarding social media and its importance in our society today, certainly we can hold known individuals accountable for what they, for the tools that they're building in this communication revolution. I mean, I'm looking just today. The AP put out a story about how Meta, aka Facebook, you know, we know that last year and the year before, they reduced the number of people at Facebook whose jobs are exclusively about civil and protecting civil and elections integrity. We know that. In the past many months, they've only released one press release, a one-pager about what they're going to do about the midterms, whereas from 2016 to roughly 2018, they put out, you know, virtually one a month. They are reducing the access that researchers have to data about how people are using Facebook. So I just put that out as an example of how part of the problem right now isn't so much what's persuasive. It's also how a company or companies are deliberately, you know, using a fire hose and pushing into the bloodstream of this democracy a form of persuasion that is toxic. And we can do something about that, Sean and Zach, I think.
I think when we talk about social media platforms such as Meta and these emerging sort of things, is that the most important thing from a communication revolution standpoint would be for the first time the average everyday citizen has the power of mass communication. They could publish, record, broadcast something that was only accessible to a certain elite or few. And so what we're experiencing is kind of the and Facebook and the rest are encouraging that as much as possible. And so I think that has been an absolute challenge. But I also am hesitant to endorse that either the government or even a huge corporation such as Meta will have the foresight or responsibility with such power to control for everything. And I think it's something that people get what they want out of these platforms. But I also think we are starting to see, you know, people develop a certain awareness for how to use them. And ideally, they will not be so susceptible to dangerous claims.
Yeah, no, I take your point. And I'm not arguing that Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, whatever, social media can control for everything. But I am wondering how basically capitalism plays into all of this, because we also know, I mean, this is just known that, you know, Facebook itself has done internal tests on how with a, you know, minuscule drop in engagement, right, if they make certain algorithmic changes, they might get like a 0.05% drop in engagement. It could actually reduce the amount of misinformation out there by, you know, in double-digit percentages. But they just won't do it because it's, you know, bad for business. They won't even risk that little bit of loss of engagement. So, you know, I think there's a, you know, there's another factor here that we have to think about. But before we wrap up today, though, I do still want to hear about whether or not you think, both of you think, there are other practical things that we can do, because we could talk about social media until we're blue in the face, but there are other forms of communication and persuasion out there that are worthy of strengthening. And what would those be?
Yeah, I think so. And look, for the very reasons you just outlined, Facebook is not going to save us. They're in the business of making money. They're not in the business of propping up a liberal democracy. And I'm hoping that what we have seen in the last several years is a reminder about how fragile this whole thing is. There's just no way around this. And we say this very clearly in the book. Democracy demands ethical commitments from the public. And the values that undergird those commitments, tolerance, respect for rule of law, a commitment to protecting minority rights, we, the citizens, bring those values to democracy. We force our democracy to bend to those principles. They are not inherent to democracy. They're not inherent to democracy itself. So in the end, people are going to have to make better and wiser choices. And if they don't, this movie won't end well. But again, we just saw in Kansas, democracy still works. You know, tweet less, vote more. It does work. You know, and we talk in the book about, you know, the need to reinforce local journalism. I think it's a tragedy that our politics has become more nationalized and more abstract and more tribalistic. You know, I think we really believe that local media should be seen as a right of all citizens. And there's a case that the press clause of the First Amendment affirms a right of access to newspapers. This is not a panacea, but I think it would be a nice antidote to the current climate. And it's something that should have bipartisan support. Mm.
Well, Jack, you get the last thought here as we wrap up.
What is it that Churchill said, that democracy is the worst system, or except for all the others? Or
Amen.
Anyway, the paradox being it's the best we can do and it isn't so good.
Well, Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst, thank you as always. And Sean Illing and Zach Gershberg, co-authors of The Paradox of Democracy, Free Speech, Open Media, and Perilous Persuasion. It was great to have both of you on the show. Thank you so much. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. You.